Welcome to Ugeria, broadcasting live from Business Radio X Studios. Ugeria is a Greek word meaning health of body and mind in aging individuals. Ugeria Radio is a weekly show celebrating the heroes that contribute to the Ugeria of our elderly and disabled population. Now joining us in the studio are your hosts, Sam Grass and Brad Culp.
Good morning. This is Brad. It's July 25th. It's a sweltering day in Atlanta, and Sam has escaped it. He's in the Great White North in the Canadian wilderness with seven Boy Scouts. And we're glad he's got a chance to have a break. I've got Trevor in the studio with me this morning. Good morning, Trevor.
Morning, Brad. How are you?
I'm good. You have a mic for a change.
I do. Oh, I figured he's on vacation. I'll fill in.
A little backup support for me.
Yeah.
Excellent. Thank you. Well, we have a real interesting show this morning, a topic that is of huge interest to anybody that has an aging relative. And if you haven't been through this topic with someone, you will at some point. Our guest is Jennifer Curry. Jennifer is with the Georgia Department of Public Health, and she is a program consultant for the Older Driver Safety Program in the Office of Injury Prevention. That's a mouthful.
It is.
Welcome. Thank you for being here this morning.
Well, thank you for the invitation. I really appreciate it.
As we always start our show, we'd like to have you just give us a little bit of background on yourself. Tell us where you're from and where you went to school and how you got to be doing what you're doing now.
Sure. Well, thanks a lot again for the invitation for this very challenging and emotional topic. I'm originally from Ohio, so when you were talking about the Great White North, I wanted to escape that because I hate cold weather, so I moved to the Atlanta area about 12 years ago. I have a master's degree in public health from Emory University and also a certificate in aging from the Boston University School of Social Work. And as I said, I moved here from Ohio about 12 years ago. I love talking about where I am and what I'm doing for a living because it kind of took me a long time to get here, but I finally feel like I've found my place. I grew up in a very, very small town, and at the end of a dead-end lane, they built a nursing home across the street from our house when I was probably about 9 or 10. And that nursing home played such a pivotal role in the rest of my life. My maternal grandmother ended up there, but even before that, my mother and I volunteered on a regular basis. And a lot of the residents of the nursing home, some of whom were older adults, some of whom were younger adults with mental illness, tended to come out of the facility a lot and wander around the town, some intentionally, some unintentionally. So we had to do a lot of advocacy for those members of our community. A lot of times they ended up in our yard confused and lost. And so we did a lot of advocacy both inside the nursing home and outside of the nursing home. So I've always been interested in aging. My grandparents, I was born kind of late in life, so my grandparents were always much older than my friend's grandparents. So being around older people is just natural to me. But when I went back to get my master's degree kind of late in life in public health, there's so much you can do with public health. And I kept hearing the population is aging, the population is aging. And, you know, I really saw an opportunity there to make a difference with both public health and aging.
Well, it's a common theme. You know, we hear a lot that people that have dedicated their lives to working with seniors, it kind of ties back to some event or, you know, some kind of personal story. And that's interesting, you know, being from a small town and in a part of town where they build this thing and suddenly you've got people wandering through your yard. So when you went off to school, did you know that you would end up
no
serving seniors?
No, it was almost like a brick to the head of like, oh, why didn't I think of this before? I got my undergraduate degree in Ohio State University in Women's Studies, and then I waited, I think, about 15 years to go back and get a master's degree. I was working in libraries for over a decade. And so, you know, and again, a lot of our patrons were older adults as well. So it was just kind of a natural progression. And then again, when I went to school for public health, I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do with it. I just liked the fact that the degree taught you a lot of practical skills. And I wasn't sure if I would tie that into my library research background or what. And then I just suddenly, it just all came together with the public health and aging. And I thought that is a perfect mix of the two things that I love.
So when you graduated with your master's degree, mm-hmm. then what did you do after that?
Well, my first job in aging was actually at the Atlanta Regional Commission, and they serve as the Area Agency on Aging for the 10-County Atlanta region, and they were wrapping up a 4-year grant called Aging Atlanta, and when I heard about that, I just thought it was fantastic, and so they hired me to help finish out that grant, and then when it ended, they offered me a full-time position, and even though it wasn't technically a public health job, I accepted the position working on the AgeWise Connection. So I became a certified information and referral specialist in aging, taking calls from all over the region from a variety of people telling such personal stories and really looking for help. And I would recommend that position for anyone who works in aging, because even though it wasn't technically a public health job, you know, the amount of information about the services that are out there, I mean, it really was very eye-opening, and the lack of services that are out there, especially transportation.
Yeah, transportation seems to be a perennial big issue.
It is a huge, huge issue.
And you know, we have public transportation here in Atlanta, but it's, you know, you have to be pretty mobile and pretty able to walk.
And you have to live in an area where it actually goes.
Right.
And, you know, as you can imagine, being in your 70s or 80s and trying to suddenly learn how to navigate public transportation, if you happen to be fortunate enough to even have it, a lot of the rural areas don't have it. And in fact, right. when I was working at ARC was when Clayton County discontinued its bus service, mm-hmm. and including the paratransit, which was for people older and with disabilities.
Right.
And a lot of people trying to get to dialysis that couldn't anymore.
You know, the thing that kind of brought this to light for us is we do have caregivers in our business that don't drive.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a handful that try to take public transportation.
Mm-hmm.
And I can recall a couple of cases where the caregiver would get dropped off by the bus and walk 3/4 of a mile.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's just no way. It's hard enough for a caregiver to do that that's able-bodied and well and motivated to get to her case. And you think about the challenges that presents. I mean, if it's raining, if it's cold, if it's hot, you know, even walking 3/4 of a mile on a day like today, could be brutal, yeah. And then, you know, exacerbate the situation by, you know, adding a walker to the mix or a cane or something. It's just not going to happen. So,
and you know, this could be a topic for a whole other show, but I will say that, you know, since I work in the Office of Injury Prevention, we look not just at drivers but also pedestrian safety, mm-hmm. and there is a lot of data out there that shows that people walking to and from transit are really at risk for, they call them motor vehicle crashes, even though it might be involve a car and a pedestrian. So those caregivers are not only having these brutal situations, but they also are potentially at risk for injury and fatality as well.
It is interesting because, you know, you every now and then I'll be driving down the road and I'll look over and see somebody walking, and there's no sidewalk.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a worn path, you know, in the grass, and you can, so it's obvious that people walk that every day for exactly that reason, trying to get to transportation. And it's you know, it's one thing when there's a broad sidewalk there, but you know, when you're walking on a narrow piece of grass, somebody stumbles, they fall into the street, or the car gets too close. Yeah, it's a big
challenge.
We have
a long way to go in the Atlanta area, but
we do.
We are working on it.
Yeah. Well, so this is, you know, it's a good segue. You're a program consultant for the Older Driver Safety Program. So tell us a little bit about what that is.
Sure, my pleasure. I think we're really fortunate in Georgia to have a program like this funded. It is housed in the Department of Public Health, and I'm the manager coordinator of the program. But the funds come from the Governor's Office of Highway Safety. So it's what in public health we sometimes call a non-traditional partnership, and something that I find really exciting to have highway safety funds and a governor's office of highway safety in Georgia that is very aware of and supportive of the older driver issue, shall we say. So they fund the program and have funded it, I believe, since 2006. And a large component of the program is the Older Driver Task Force. Now, the Georgia Older Driver Task Force meets about once a month, and we have great representation from all different type of partners from different agencies. But that's really only part of what we do. I think a lot of times people think we are the Older Driver Task Force, but really the Older Driver Task Force is made up of all of our partner agencies, and our role at the Department of Public Health is mostly just to facilitate that happening.
So give me an example of who's involved in that.
Oh, sure, my pleasure. The Georgia chapter of the Alzheimer's Association has been one of our longtime partners. They used to host our meetings, and now we have our meetings at the Wesley Woods campus at the Emory University, and that's actually that meeting space and our conference line, which is quite costly, are provided by the Emory Center for Health and Aging, which is what they call the Geriatric Education Center for Georgia and the region. That's an example. But then we also have the Governor's Office of Highway Safety. We have Department of Driver Services, which is a really critical partnership as well. And I could go on and I won't, but AARP, I mean, we try to get all of the players, so to speak, at the table.
So I guess then the objective of the Older Driver Safety Program is primarily education, or?
Well, no, not exactly, and I'm glad you asked that. because these are highway funds, our stated objective is to reduce injuries and fatalities among Georgia's older drivers. So it's very focused. One of the terms we use a lot in public health is data-driven. So the data shows that older adults are more likely to be injured or die as a result of a motor vehicle crash than other age groups. And, you know, I wish I could show, a graph right now, but basically teenagers and young adults have typically had a very high crash fatality rate. And then it kind of tapers off a little bit and is kind of average for those of us in our 40s and 50s. And then as people age, you can see an increase in that. So it's not that older drivers are in more crashes or that they cause more crashes. It's that if they are in a crash, their likelihood of surviving that crash is much higher, and their likelihood of sustaining severe injuries that might take a very long time to heal from also increase.
So if the objective, well, how do you accomplish that objective?
That's a tricky one. And, you know, I say that because anytime you have any public health program, you want to evaluate everything you're doing and make sure that you're actually making a difference. It's very hard to say that a lot of activities then translate into a reduction of crashes among a certain age group. That's very hard to do in any age group. So what we do is we have a lot of objectives each year. The objectives, some stay the same, some change on a year-to-year basis. But one of the things we do is the education piece. We really do a lot of educating. We educate older adults. We educate drivers. We educate caregivers. We educate our partner agencies like the Department of Driver Services. We educate healthcare providers. That's a big, big, big component of our program. So, yes, that education is really key. But what we look at is actually changing the environment. So, you know, a lot of public health programs work on individual behavior change, and with this program, we take that up to another level, and we do things like train engineers and planners, training them with an awareness, hoping that they will come away with an awareness of how they can design roads and sidewalks and things like that in public transportation so that it benefits and is more conducive to older driving, and the idea being that then that makes the roads safer for all of us.
Interesting. So Can you give any examples of how that's been manifested in Atlanta?
Sure, of course. Well, one of the things that we have been doing in the, and we are a statewide program, so I do want to mention that even though a lot of our activities are housed here in the Atlanta area, we are statewide and try to do a really good job of branching out to the entire state and providing what we call technical support to different agencies. And one of the activities that we've done, and I believe it was done in Macon the first year, and then in the Atlanta region the last 2 years, and then this year I'm looking for a different, I'm planning it in a different region, is we partner with the Federal Highway Administration, and they actually train. They have a huge amount of information on their website, very technical. I tried to read it on MARTA one day, and it just was way over my head. It's definitely geared towards engineers, but what we do as a program is we help recruit the engineers in a different regions, one each year, and we hold these workshops. And then we actually evaluate the workshop in partnership with the Federal Highway Administration by asking participants, the engineers and planners, what their knowledge is of these issues before the workshop and then after the workshop. And then we follow up with them a few months later to say, well, have you actually been able to accomplish any of these? And if not, what are the barriers to that? So that's still a work in progress, but we've held that, I believe we're on the fourth or fifth annual coming up, training of engineers.
Now, what would be an example of something that is done in light of older driver safety in terms of the planning?
Sure. Well, you know, larger font sizes and signs is a big one. And again, the I don't want to say the motto, but the theory behind this, what the message, excuse me, that Federal Highway Administration is constantly reiterating is that these changes aren't just for older drivers. It's not asking for, you know, all of the roads to be redesigned so that everyone who's older can drive on them better. It's really these things help all of us. Better signage. Older adults have a really what they call increased sensitivity to glare, and it's probably no surprise to anyone listening that driving at night, even when we are in our 40s, and I can vouch for this, you know, the glare from the oncoming cars becomes a little difficult to manage, even more so as we age. So there are this is a little out of my realm since I'm not an engineer, but definitely ways to design signs and the contrast sensitivity in the signs. Left turns have shown in the data to be a particular challenge for older drivers. And so, again, I won't go into the technical details, but these multiple left turn lanes are sometimes very difficult for older drivers to navigate. So the manual that the Federal Highway Administration uses, I know the listeners can't see this, but it's huge. It's like phone book size.
That's interesting. You talk about left turns, and I don't know if, two parts of the country come to mind. One is New Jersey, and the other is Michigan. I don't know if you've driven in either of those cities.
Michigan, I was, in fact, just in Michigan, and growing up in Ohio, I spent a lot of time in Michigan, but not New Jersey.
So in Michigan, you go beyond the intersection, you do a U-turn, you come back, and you turn right. So you don't turn left in the intersection, which is, you know, to me it seems counterintuitive because it seems like a U-turn is more dangerous than a left turn, but obviously they've done some thinking on this. And then in New Jersey, you actually kind of pull off if you're going to turn left. You'll pull off to the right, you know, almost like an exit ramp, and then come around to a light because there's no traffic. It's almost like a cloverleaf sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'll come up to a light and then go across with the light. So
interesting.
And that seems a lot safer, but it's also a pretty large undertaking to create those kinds of intersections.
Well, it is, and you have to have the political or, you know, financial buy-in to make those changes. And, you know, again, left turns have shown to be very difficult, especially for older people to manage. So encouraging people to only take right turns, I would say, not being the expert on this, that's usually a pretty good thing. But you also have to keep in mind, and this has been kind of an awareness-raising opportunity for myself is that traditionally, most roadway design is all about reducing congestion. I mean, that is the primary goal, is to reduce congestion. So that's why I love this initiative of training the engineers and the planners, because there's more to it than just congestion. There's safety issues as well. And so I'll have to look it up now. The library has never gone away from me. And so I love to do research. And so I'm thinking, I'm gonna want to look at that in Michigan and New Jersey, because I would be curious. What I would want to know is, what was the rationale behind that? Was it that it saves lives? Was it that it reduces congestion? Was it something to do with older drivers? Because across the country, the Federal Highway Administration is a national entity, and they're doing these trainings all across the country. And so I think the mind frame, and when you hear a lot about livable communities and lifelong communities, I think the mindset is fortunately changing.
Right. Right. That would be interesting. I also remember a Mythbusters episode. I don't know if you ever watched that show, but the hypothesis, this was done in San Francisco, and the hypothesis was that a delivery truck, given a certain set of deliveries, could drive farther but get there faster by only making right turns. And, so they created this route through San Francisco with 5 or 6 package drops. And I don't even remember the outcome, but I thought it was an interesting concept, about constantly turning right. And, the notion is you're not waiting on the light, but, also you're also not putting yourself in harm's way by going into the middle of an intersection and crossing.
That's very true. The safety issues. And, roundabouts, there are a lot of fear around roundabouts, a lot of misinformation. But if those are put in along with education, targeted educational campaigns, those are actually in that manual as really, really, really good to help not just older adults, but everyone, because you're not stopping. You're not, technically you're not stopping. You're entering the roadway, but you're not making these harsh turns in front of oncoming traffic. And they work in other countries.
They've been around in Europe for forever, and actually in the Northeast there's a lot of roundabouts, but I'm seeing more and more of them here in the Atlanta area. There's one over by I live up in Johns Creek, and there's one over by Joan Glancy that they just put in Duluth. And I think by and large they're helpful. However, you're right about the education bit.
That's critical.
Otherwise you got people just pulling in there, not realizing.
Having never driven in one before, or avoiding it because they're scared of it.
Yeah. So that's interesting. Well, let's chat a little bit about, and we were talking before the show here about older drivers and loved ones that have concerns about their older drivers. What do you see in this program in terms of helping individual drivers? And do you look at that, helping individual drivers be safe?
Of course. Now, the way that our program works is that our, and again, these are some public health terms that I'm going to throw around here. Our target audience, that's actually professionals. So the mindset is that we help professionals who are already helping the individuals. We help them to better serve the individuals that they're serving already. Now, we do education occasionally. We did a great panel presentation for the Gwinnett County Caregivers Annual Conference that we were invited to speak at. And, certainly we get calls occasionally. And I will, anytime an older adult or a caregiver calls me, I will give them information and then refer them to their area agency on aging, because they're the ones that are really designed to help them with those types of issues. So, sure, we do a lot for individuals, but our program really is designed as a public health program to help a whole population of people. And we do that by helping professionals. I hope that answers the question. It's a little complicated, but the idea being that by helping change the environment, by helping to change policy, by helping to do these things that are much broader, then that will help our partner agencies serve their clients, their professionals.
So I think you'd mentioned health providers, caregivers, mm-hmm. that sort of thing.
Sure.
So are you helping to frame the conversations that these people will have?
What we are trying to do is multifaceted. We do a lot, which I'm very proud of and excited about the multifaceted nature of this program. But in terms of the education, we educate engineers, we educate healthcare providers, we educate the area agencies on aging. But with the healthcare providers in particular, we really, as a coalition, as the Older Driver Task Force, really, really believe that physicians and other members of the healthcare team, such as social workers, nurses, physicians' assistants, that they need to be having these conversations with their patients. And there are a lot of specialists who might be having these conversations, like neurologists or geriatric physicians, geriatric nurse practitioners. But in terms of your average primary care provider being willing to have these discussions with older adults and their caregivers, be willing to take action. And by that, I mean, we try to educate physicians and other healthcare providers about what to say, and not just what to say, what tests to do, what conversations to have, but also where to refer people afterwards. Mm. Because I think sometimes when that driving conversation happens, a lot of physicians and nurses and other healthcare providers don't even know that there are area agencies on aging out there that have lists of transportation resources. So we want to get those healthcare providers to take an active role.
Right.
It's a little challenging, but
so what, you know, for a physician or some other healthcare mm-hmm. provider, what would you tell them about what to say and what tests
sure.
to perform?
Well, that's actually such a tricky question, and that's one of our biggest challenges. I just came from an international conference in Michigan on aging and mobility. So there were people there from Canada, New Zealand, Tokyo, Kuwait, all presenting on what they are doing in terms of older driver safety and mobility. And kind of the general consensus is that there is no scientifically validated test that a doctor can, there is no one single golden ticket. Mm. There is no one test that a physician can do in their office that will effectively predict whether someone should be driving or should not be driving. But we don't want that to stop these conversations. There are many, many, many other things a physician can do. For example, the Department of Driver Services has a form on their website. It's kind of hard to find, and we're working on partnering with them to kind of make that a little easier. And I've had a lot of frustrated caregivers call that have been, you know, wanting to have this conversation and not really sure what to do about it. So a physician plays a really strong role in this, because what happens is there is a form called the Request for Driver Evaluation Form, and Sam and Brad will make sure that you get that link that you can put on the podcast later. But we did a lot of work as a coalition to partner with Department of Driver Services to get this form updated. A law enforcement official, a doctor, a caregiver, anyone can fill out that form and basically report someone to the Division of Driver Services. And what that form basically says is, I have concerns about some behavior I've seen. I have concerns about this person's driving. And then the Department of Driver Services sends out a letter to the driver that says, basically, your driving has been called into question. You need to go to your doctor and have your doctor fill out this paperwork and return it to us. And then they have a medical review board that looks at the doctor, what the doctor has provided. Now, it can also work such that you don't even have to go through that paperwork. If doctors are educated, they can, and they have concerns about their patient's driving safety, they can just fill out the paperwork that they need to fill out and send it right in and avoid all of that letter situation. But one of the things I find myself repeating over and over again is, nobody wants to be the bad guy.
Right, of course. That's the crux of it, really.
Nobody wants to be the bad guy. And so with our physician, and I stumble over this a little bit, because when I came on board, it was called the Physician Awareness Project. And based on my work as an information specialist, I immediately said, wait a minute. It's not just physicians. Social workers play a role. Nurses play a role. And I'm very passionate about that. So everyone has a role to play in this. But it's really the doctors that are going to have to get involved at the end of the day between them and Department of Driver Services anyway. And so that's why the physicians have been a big target for us.
So before you get to that point, maybe you have somebody that could be a safer driver, but, you know, they've got some bad habits, or maybe they're not acknowledging their own limitations. What resources are out there to evaluate that, and what are some things that families or drivers can do to help themselves be safer drivers so they don't get to a point where somebody's having this conversation with them that says, okay, you've wrecked three cars. I'm sorry, but we're taking your keys.
Well, that's my favorite question, because I always say driving is not a black and white issue. It's not, you know, I know there's a lot of fear, and for good reason, from older adults that someone's going to take away their keys, because then that means taking away their independence.
Right.
Nobody likes to be told what to do or what they can or can't do at any age. So I love when people ask, well, what's in between? The AARP holds a driver safety course. It's not on road. It's in the classroom. But it's a really fantastic course taught, and you can go onto the AARP website and search for a class in your area. Those are held all over the place. And that's basically a one-day classroom program that, you know, has been studied. They have looked at its effectiveness. And, you know, for someone who really could stand to use an update on what the current laws are and sign recognition and really learn about what happens as you age and how you can be safer, that AARP course is a good option. One of the things that some people in the audience may be more familiar with than that are driving evaluations, and those driving assessments, also called, those are done with what they call a certified driving rehabilitation specialist, who is an occupational therapist. The downside of those is that they are quite costly. And what will happen is someone will go into an office, maybe a caregiver is concerned about their loved one and says, okay, you know, I'm not a professional mom. I can't tell you whether you can be driving or not, but we really need to have you evaluated. And so they will make an appointment with the certified driving rehabilitation specialist. Some supplemental insurance might cover part of that, but Medicare does not cover it. That's a big barrier. However, the Alzheimer's Association of Georgia has a grant right now that only runs through the end of September. That will help people to pay for these evaluations. So that's one thing that caregivers can do. Another thing is the CarFit program, and that is a national program that is being conducted here in Georgia through a couple of different entities, and the Older Driver Safety Program has been involved with that. We just did one in Gainesville on Friday, and the governor and his wife came and had their basically were checked by technicians. I'm what's called a certified CarFit technician, and basically that's to help people fit in their cars better. You would be surprised how many people could really benefit from learning how to adjust their mirrors so that they can reduce their blind spots. We want to make sure people, I know this might sound small, but make sure they know how to turn on their brights, make sure they know where their hazards are in case they are in an accident or run out of gas. So those are definitely some in-between things that we can do. But I really, really strongly believe that what we can really do is get people to be talking to their primary care physicians about this issue and have them, again, even if there's no golden ticket to say, okay, you failed this test, that means on the road you're going to fail. Even so, there are a lot of cognitive and mobility tests that doctors can do in their offices that can really help them assess whether or not someone could or should still be driving, or what kind of adjustments they might need to make in order to do that. Again, this could be a topic for another show, but this becomes really tricky when someone has any kind of cognitive impairment.
Right.
Because that really puts a completely different twist on this. That is a whole other topic. And quite frankly, a very critical issue, because if people are not able to reason or their reasoning skills are declining due to some sort of dementia, having these conversations with someone who can't be rational, you know, because of a disease, is not really going to get you very far. And so there are what we were talking about before the show, the Hartford, which is a group, an insurance company, actually has done a lot of work with what they call the MIT Age Lab, and those are trained gerontologists. And they have many, 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 many free brochures, booklets, podcasts, videos on their website that basically will help caregivers. I think one of them is called Family Conversations with Older Drivers. So they've done the research on how to have these conversations, and there are some really interesting tools in the booklets. And in fact, one of them is, I think it's called Agreement with My Family About Driving. And I listened to them present this at a conference, and it was fascinating because what they were saying is in the back of this booklet, when someone can still be rational, for example, I'm in my 40s, I could do this. In fact, I should do this, and basically go through and say, if I ever become unable to drive but not able to recognize that, here's what I want my family to do. And someone in the audience said, well, you know, my mother has dementia, and it's not, I can't go to her with this piece of paper and say, look, Mom, you signed this. You didn't want to drive, because she's not able to comprehend that. But what came out of that is that can really provide a lot of comfort to the caregivers to know that when their loved one was able to make those decisions, here on paper, this right. is what I wanted. Not so different than a living will.
That's really a terrific idea, because when you think about having that conversation with a loved one, it can't help but cause anxiety. It's mm-hmm. a very difficult conversation, and, you know, I mean, there are people there that would say, oh, honey, yes, you're right, I shouldn't be driving, here's my keys. Usually it doesn't go down that way, though.
No, it doesn't.
You know, usually it's a fight, and to your point earlier, it's taking away someone's independence, and even in a city that's got public transportation, it creates severe limitations on mobility and independence. And of course, people are going to resist that. So having a conversation in advance about what is going to happen when that day comes, and, you know, getting it in writing, I think is a terrific idea. And there are
too.
A lot of people, you know, I mean, certainly many, many people suffer from cognitive impairment as they age, but there are also many people that suffer from physical impairment and their mind is fine. And if they've signed a piece of
That's
paper
right.
like that with a loved one, then they're going to come back and say, oh, yeah, I remember that. And I may not like it, but, you know, yeah, I signed that. So
right. So there's that emotional part of it. And then I just believe that, and this is one of the things we try to do with our program, is really help caregivers to understand that they don't have to be the one that makes the decision. They might need to be the one who makes the doctor's appointment or the driving evaluation appointment or the form to Department of Driver Services.
Right.
But it's really only a doctor, in my opinion. It is, I shouldn't say in my opinion. As a coalition, you know, it really is what we believe, is that a doctor, some sort of healthcare provider, needs to be helping a family make these decisions. And that even, and I've heard many stories when I worked on the AgeWise Connection, many, many stories of people who took their loved one to a doctor. The doctor said the person shouldn't be driving anymore.
Mm.
And the person even wasn't even willing to hear it, or maybe couldn't hear it from the doctor. And so then the doctor did have to resort, or the family had to resort, to getting the license taken away. But, you know, I also heard something else once that has stuck in my head forever. It will probably always be there, which is removing access to the vehicle is sometimes much more important than removing access to the driver's license. Because as everyone knows, people with dementia, some people wander, and you can most definitely, people do wander with a vehicle, and
right,
that makes it
right.
much more dangerous because they can get much further. They could hurt other people.
Right.
But in the end, the only entity who can say yes or no to someone driving or not is the Department of Driver Services. That's it, period.
Right. Certainly, though, we've seen in our business where family members have disabled the car.
Sure.
And then told their loved one that the car's broken. And, you know, well, it's going to be really expensive to fix it. And so the car sits, and eventually the car goes away. And, you know, it's a process. But I think I want to go back to what you were saying, though, and just clarify. I think that one of the things that you were pointing out here is that when you get somebody else involved, the doctor or somebody else, it removes the personal element. It's not, you know, well, you're just trying to take away my independence. You're just trying to, you know, whatever, ruin my life, you know, which, you know, my kids say to me all the time. So, but, you know, you're using another party to make it a more objective conversation.
Yes, and I think there are two sides to that. Yes, I think that is one of the reasons we promote that, is because it can hopefully ease some of that burden on the caregivers. Of course, when someone has dementia and can't be rational, they might still be the target of a lot of anger, stress. I remember I do carry around these people with me who called into the AgeWise Connection. They will be with me for the rest of my life. And one of them was saying that her husband, they had taken, I believe they had children, and they had taken the wife and the children because the husband had advanced dementia, had taken away the vehicle or his something, the keys. And he became obsessed with trying to get in car insurance. He was convinced that he wasn't being able to drive because his insurance had expired. So then they fell prey to all of these insurance companies where he had called to get quotes, given them his information, and then they were calling and badgering the family.
Oh,
and
no.
If the wife could get to the phone, she would call and she would pick up the phone and say, he has dementia. And one of the insurance companies actually said, well, we don't care, put him on the phone. So,
wow.
But if he had not had, I didn't know this at the time, but you know, if he had not had a valid driver's license, they would have been able to run that through the insurance company. But my point is really that it's not a rational thing. Mm-hmm. He was scared. He was not able to rationalize that he no longer could drive. And so that's still going to be an emotional issue no matter who handles it.
But
really easing some of that burden, because quite frankly, from a safety standpoint, I can't decide. I would have no way of knowing whether someone should still be driving or not, nor would most caregivers. So really, that's a professional.
Right.
And the American Medical Association, which is the association that most trained physicians look to, they have a whole booklet, a course where the doctors can get credit for taking it, about how to assess counseling and assessing older drivers. So even though there might not be a magic ticket, there still are many cognitive and physical tests that doctors can do in that office. We just need to work harder to get them to do that. And that is something that caregivers need to be pushing for.
Right. Very good. Well, as we wrap this up here, for families that might be starting to deal with a loved one that has cognitive impairment, that have some concerns about driving, maybe not right today, but, you know, as an impending issue, what might be a piece of advice you would give to that family to start the process?
Well, a couple pieces of advice, but they all tie back to the Georgia chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. The National Alzheimer's Association has an action plan that, you know, where they basically pick their priorities for the year. And they still haven't picked driver safety, but the Georgia chapter has. And they are very, very, very committed. We have a great group of people working in that office, which is right around this area where we're recording. And I would say that my answers of what to do would all come back to them. That even though it says Alzheimer's Association, any type of cognitive impairment or dementia, really they have a fantastic helpline. I wish I had the number. I have it almost memorized, but I would hate to give out the wrong number. But call them, ask them for support. They have all kinds of programs there that can help. And as I said, right now they do have a grant to help pay for a driving assessment. And there aren't a whole lot of trained driving assessors out there, but there are a few in the Atlanta area. And even though it does end up being quite costly, it really is a very elaborate process. And, you know, the Alzheimer's Association's position is that dementia is a progressive disease. And just because someone has a dementia diagnosis, especially as early as we are able to detect that now. So you hear MCI a lot, mild cognitive impairment. So even if somebody has a diagnosis of some type of dementia or cognitive impairment, that does not mean they have to stop driving. Absolutely not. What it means, though, is that their driving abilities should be assessed on a regular basis. That should be part of their care plan with their physician, because it is progressive. And the sad fact of the matter is, with any progressive dementia, someone is going to lose their ability to drive safely eventually.
Eventually, yeah. Thank you. Good advice. Jennifer, for our listeners that might want to get more information or contact you, how might they do that?
Well, they can, and please, by all means, whoever is listening to this, it is a complicated topic, and I'm sure we just skimmed the surface, so please, please call me. My number at work is 404-657-2894. That will take you directly to me. I do have voicemail, so if I'm out of the office, please leave me a message with your name and number, and I'll get back to you as soon as I can. My email address is a little long, but I'm going to give it. It's J.L. Curry, so that's J.L.C.U.R.R.Y. at D like dog, H like horse, R like rabbit, dot state, STATE, dot GA for Georgia, dot US. I will also send Brad a lot of links to some of the programs that I've mentioned today, some of the services that are out there, so that if you go to the website, through the Ugeria website, you will be able to click on those links pretty easily.
Great, great. So we'll embed those in the show write-up, and that way there'll be some additional resource for our listeners. So,
great.
Well, very good. Jennifer, thank you again for being here today. Great show and so much content. We'd like to invite you back, because we had several points during the show where we said this could be the topic of a whole another show. So we'll look forward to that. I want to thank our listeners for tuning in. And as always, you can listen to a rebroadcast of this show at www.ugeria.com. And as we always close the show, if the youth of this nation are its greatest national resource, then it stands to reason that the seniors of this nation are its greatest national treasure. Thank you and God bless.
Ugeria Radio is sponsored by Griswold Special Care and broadcast live from the Business Radio X studios.